This is Scott Richmond.
And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Arnie Sherman, good morning.
Scott Richmond, it's a pleasure to be here once again with you this morning.
Arnie, you're saying that now, but we have a surprise for our audience today.
And what is that surprise?
I'm going to interview you, Arnie. We have spent the last 5+ years.
Well, actually, I was going to tell you, it's our 5th anniversary. We started in October 2015. So we've been doing this regularly for 5 years now. And as you know, the show
is... Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary, Scott. The show is What Do You Know? And I was thinking the other day, we should talk about what our listeners don't know.
Good point.
And so you're going to interview me, apparently, today. And in all fairness, I think it's good for our listeners to also hear about you. So when you get done grilling me or however you plan to do this, I will reciprocate with an interview of you.
It's a great idea. Right, because we're going to familiarize.
Well, after 5 years, it's about time, right?
Right. And we've interviewed, I want to say, if not the tens, almost over 100 guests.
Right.
In the 5 years.
Yes.
At least
100.
At least 100 guests.
Well, considering sometimes we've had more than one in the studio. So
we sure have.
We maybe got up to 150 different human beings in here with us.
Both in person, via Zoom, post-COVID, and on the phone. From as far as New York, Los Angeles. Do we do any international?
I don't think anybody called in internationally, but we've... actually, we did. We did a show with a Canadian. We had, right. We did the HIV show.
That's right.
So we've been North America.
But right now...
We've reached out.
Right. And we're going to zero in on Missoula, Montana.
Right.
And Arnie Sherman, this is your life.
Exactly. That's what the judge said to me last week, but I got off light.
Right. We're going to learn all about Arnie. It's going to be a fact. I know some of this story, but he really needs to tell it for you, dear audience, and that's what he will do in the next hour. Back after this. Here's how I captured you. Okay. Here's what I thought when I thought about you. I said Arnie lives a life in film. If you know anything about characters in classic films, who is Arnie? Arnie is the Paul Newman character in The Hustler. He's Woody Allen's Zelig, because I know he loves that film. He's Harvey Keitel in Pulp Fiction. He's the cleaner. He's the guy. He's the fixer in Ray Donovan. So Arnie is all these characters. This is what he does, right? But give us a little background. Where were you born? Where are you from?
You want the story.
I want the full story.
The long and winding, meandering road to Missoula, Montana.
How did you get here?
Do you want the glossed over version, or do you want the nitty, version of it?
I'll ask you, where were you born?
I was born in Bronx Hospital in New York City. And the first place that we lived after I born was a tenement. I lived in Dyckman Street in the housing project there. So I was born and first grew up in a housing project in New York City.
This is north of Manhattan for the folks that don't know the geography of the island, right? The Bronx,
yes.
Dyckman.
Dyckman's in Manhattan. So, right by the bridge. Yeah, right by the bridge in Manhattan.
That's right.
Even though I was born in the Bronx. My father was working at that time when I was born for Universal Pictures in their office in Manhattan. And I think he was making $75 a week or $100. I mean, not more than $100 a week back in those days.
How big of an apartment?
Small apartment, one bedroom apartment at that point. My sister, I had a sister that was born 19 months later, and we shared a bedroom after that for a few years. We moved out, and by the time I was 5 years old.
And where did you move to?
We moved to Queens. And we moved to Glen Oaks in Queens, which was another, at that time, sort of housing project. It wasn't rent control, but it was one of these newer kind of developments.
Like LaFrac.
You know, hundreds of little apartments. and we lived there for a while. And then the movie industry took a sort of a tough turn because color TV and all television was booming. And so they closed a lot of offices, and my father was relocated to St. Louis, Missouri.
What, really?
Yes.
So from Queens, St. Louis, Missouri. By the way, before we leave Queens, your father and mother had family, right? Brothers and sisters? Do you have cousins?
Yeah, I had cousins. My mother had a sister and a brother. My father had a brother, and they all, at that point, were married and had children.
And your parents were first-generation Americans, or were they born overseas?
No, they were born here, and okay. My mother was 18 when she married my father, who was 20 right after the war.
And your grandparents came through Ellis Island?
Yes. My grandfather came from Russia through Ellis Island. Well, there were four sets of parents. Three of the four came through Ellis Island.
Through Ellis Island. Got it. So when you're 5 years old, the family moves
to Queens.
Queens. And then when did you move to St. Louis?
When I was about 10 years old.
So why St. Louis?
Because the movie industry was in turmoil and closing a lot of offices, and they sent my father out to St. Louis to run the office in St. Louis.
Got it.
We only lasted there about a year. One, because as big city folks, I mean, they had only lived in New York their whole life. My father was in the military and traveled. He actually liberated concentration camps in World War II as a medic. So he had traveled and seen some of the world, but he had only lived really in New York and a brief stint in California. They really didn't like St. Louis. And then the St. Louis office closed, and they wanted to move him to Springfield, Illinois. And he thought St. Louis was small enough. So he quit a 10-year career.
Quit
the film business.
To do what?
Well, he didn't know what he was going to do. He was unemployed. And then
St. Louis?
Yeah, came back, and we moved in with his parents, my paternal grandfather and grandmother, until he found a new career focus. So we lived in Oceanside in my grandparents' house. My grandfather was a labor organizer and was a business agent for the Painters and Paper Hanger Union, and had a very good district. He had Midtown Manhattan.
Wow.
And
he's busy.
Yeah, but my father didn't want to go into that, in the union work or whatever. And eventually, after a few months of being unemployed, he one of our relatives, a second cousin, had married into a family that was running a chain of carpet stores.
Oh, that's right. Well, put a pin in that, though. Back to your grandfather. How did he get the job doing the union work?
Well, my grandfather grew up, he was an interesting guy. He was an amateur boxer. He was born in Russia, but moved here when he was 2 years old to the United States. His father was a conductor on the railroad, Long Island Railroad. And he bounced around in jobs and finally got a job, as a union tradesman, as a painter. And then when the Depression came in, he didn't have a job. He moved to Buffalo, New York, and worked for 2 years. He was married with children. He moved there to work for 2 years as a painter to earn $15 a week so he could send $9 a week home. And he lived on $6. He lived in a boarding house that was 50 cents a night, and worked for 2 years as a painter
to send money home.
To send $9 a week home to support the family. And then after 2 years, Roosevelt was president, and they had, they had a lot of the New Deal and a lot of activity going on. He moved back to Manhattan and worked as a painter until 1948, the year I was born.
What do you remember about your grandfather growing up?
Well, I was very close with him. I was closer with him than my father because when I was born, I was born on my grandparents' anniversary. So I was like their anniversary present.
Wow.
And he ran for office and got elected to be a union representative. And
it's an important job.
He kept that job for 20 years. It wasn't as taxing in demand. My dad was working retail hours, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week.
So back to your dad. He got a job with Allen Carpet.
It started off as a measure boy, installing carpet. At that time 31 years old, but he started from the bottom, measuring rooms, installing carpet, salesman, worked his way up to be general manager of the company.
For our audience in Missoula, Allen Carpet is the great floors of New York.
Yeah, they
New
were all
Jersey.
Over and Connecticut and Massachusetts. It was all on the East Coast.
Huge
at one
chain
point.
And that was your cousin's business.
Yeah, he married the owner's
wow
daughter.
Okay.
So, yeah, I spent a lot of time with my grandfather doing things. He didn't spend much time with his two sons, my father and...
So he was spending time with you.
Yeah.
Did he speak... Was his English good?
Oh, well, yeah, he was born...
He was okay, you're... Okay, right, sorry.
What happened a lot, and you probably know this growing up, I'm not telling you anything new, the first generation Americans sort of eschewed, you know, anything about their, you know, being an immigrant. So right. He didn't learn to speak. He didn't go to, you know, synagogue. You know,
right.
He didn't speak. He spoke a little Yiddish, but he didn't.
He wanted to assimilate.
Yeah, he wanted to assimilate. He wasn't reverent in that way. You know, he became a cigar smoking amateur boxer, painter, all around, you know, good guy.
Likeable guy.
Everybody liked my grandfather.
What was his name?
Harry. Harry Sherman.
Harry Sherman.
Or for, you know, on his birth certificate, it said Heschel.
And what did your mom do?
My mom worked off and on in the jewelry business. She got a job at 16 years old at Bottomwood Teller in the millinery department, which is hats and
right.
pins and all that. It was her first job. The interesting job of all of my relatives was my grandmother, my father's mother, Rosalie. You know, Sherman, but original her maiden name was Haas. She was the first woman ever hired at Underwood Typewriter.
Wow.
And there were over 200 men working in the office, and she was the only woman. And I once asked her, how did you feel about being the only woman working in a, you know, male company? And she said, it was great. People brought me flowers. They took me out to lunch. She liked the perks. And she met my grandfather there. He had been working there part-time, and they started going out, and she said he asked her to marry him.
Paint a picture, Arnie, for us. Growing up in New York, so you're back from St. Louis. What's New York like in the 50s and the 60s when you're kind of becoming aware of it?
Let me just finish the one thing. My grandmother said, I won't marry until I have a 1-carat diamond ring. And they were engaged for almost 8 years until he was able to save up to buy a ring.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's lovely.
Yeah, he was a determined guy. New York was a lot like, for those of you who are listening in who remember the Honeymooners, Ralph Cramden being the bus driver in kind of stark-looking apartments.
Right.
And, you know, you had a TV set with a big magnifying glass in the front so you could see the little screen, made it bigger so you could see what was going on. You know, subways, you know, were 15 cents.
But it was bustling, right?
It was so bustling. There was a lot of action. There was a lot of activity going on.
Right.
You could feel the energy. People were, you know, were free to, you know, even as a kid at 10, 11, 12 years old, before we moved out to Long Island, I would tell my parents I was going out to play baseball, and I would get on a bus and take it to the subway and go into Manhattan and hang out for the day, walking around. I used to sneak into the movie theaters by hanging out at the exit door, and when people came out, I would walk in. Yeah, and watch movies.
And that was probably started your fascination with movies in addition to what your dad did.
Well, my uncle.
Uncle Harry.
Well, not Uncle Harry.
Okay.
Uncle Georgie, George Sherman, was my grandfather's youngest brother. And when he was 14 years old, he ran away from home, hopped a freighter from New York to L.A., went around the horn to L.A.,
wow,
got a job working in the film archives for Republic Pictures, and worked his way up to the time, by the time he was in his late 20s, he was directing movies.
Are you kidding me?
including the Three Musketeers serial. They had serials
in those
days. They were short movies, about 20, 30 minutes, that they used to pair with a feature film, so you get two for one. And the thing about the Three Musketeers was, one of the Three Musketeers was John Wayne before he got to be well known. So my great uncle George was very close with John Wayne, and he directed over 70 movies. And so that's how my father got to work for Universal, because ultimately George was making films for Universal after he left Republic.
Was George the first of that generation to go west?
Yes.
He was a frontiersman.
Well, I would love to, you know, really know his full life story. There's hardly anybody around anymore who could tell that story. I found a lot of it by digging around, but again, at 14, uneducated.
Yeah.
He was 5'2". He was a short man.
Right.
Went out and somehow worked his way up to become a feature film, directed over 70 feature films, with lots of famous stars, Errol Flynn, Jeff Chandler, you know, Victor Mature, did more movies with John Wayne than anybody except John Ford.
Does he have any, his children, did you keep in touch with them? Those are your aunts and uncle. Well,
they were third
cousins.
Not much, because he went off to California. Everybody was in New York. We saw him at funerals and major anniversaries when he came.
So he was present when he needed to be present.
He was present when he needed. And then he directed some TV stuff. He directed some Sea Hunt, Gentle Ben, Daniel Boone. He moved into that area later on in his career.
So when he came into town to visit, did you just... like talk to him and
He would bring pictures. I lost it somewhere. I had a box of almost every Hollywood star with a picture to Arnie signed by, and his he used to throw parties in his house in Beverly Hills, and his claim to fame was he had a big white baby grand piano, and every star that came to his house signed the piano. So he had hundreds of signatures on this piano.
Ladies and gentlemen, for those that don't know Arnie well, he's a collector of rare items and collectibles in the sports space, but I'm imagining this was what started you, is some of this film
stuff. I had some of this, and it was I wish I still had it.
Well, what did you do with it?
You know, I left it at home when I went away to college. My mom probably threw it out or whatever. You know, I just don't know. It disappeared somewhere. But that's my father went out for a year after World War II to work in the industry, and he was a cameraman. My uncle got him a job to learn how to be a cameraman. But my father was, at that age, was a very strikingly handsome man. He looked like Errol Flynn. And everybody that, when he was doing camera work, they kept on saying, well, why don't you get in front of the camera? And they had a vision of my dad, as my dad tells me, of him being like the good-looking bad guy. You know, he wasn't an actor trained, but they would have him, you know, as part of a gang of some sort. And he was thinking about doing it, but he had left his high school sweetheart back in New York, my mother, who freaked out about the idea that he might stay in L.A. and become in the movie business.
Sure.
So she used all of her feminine wile. To lure him back to New York and marry her.
Let's do a quick ID. Our guest is Arnie Sherman. You are listening to What Do You Know? And we're learning a lot more about Arnie on this show. Let's get right back to it. So to set us the stage, we are back in New York. You've come back from St. Louis. What year are we in and what grade are you in?
Well, I came back, and it was 1959, and I was in seventh grade, and I came back, and we were in Oceanside for a while, which has, some people know, it's not part of the New York public school system.
Yeah.
And then my dad got the job. We were talking about Alan Carpenter, and then we moved back to Glen Oaks.
To Queens.
Yeah, to Queens.
So Oceanside at that time in the 50s was a growing kind of suburb, right?
Oh, it was a hot suburb to be in because it was close to the water.
Right, it was beautiful.
Yeah, it was a nice place. They had a Nathan's on the way to Long Beach.
Mostly Jewish?
Jewish-Italian.
Italian, you know, I mean, Irish Catholic.
Yeah.
So like everything Long Island was...
It was all mixed. It was, you know... Right.
And how did everybody get along and how did...
Well, it was tight. You know, the house wasn't designed for, you know... The four of us to live there with my grandmother.
So how about groups of friends? How did you get along with
that? I didn't have many friends there because I was new, and coming in. And then I was wrestling, you know, in school, and I broke my ankle. And so I was, you know, not able to participate. But we didn't live there more than a year, and we moved back to Glen Oaks.
Going into eighth grade.
Yeah. Okay. So what happened was I was still in seventh grade, but I was young in seventh grade. I was 12. And when we finally moved to Long Island, this is more detail than anybody listening wants to know, but I had a thing in New York called SP, Special Progress Class. And you take an aptitude test, and somehow that day I was on. And so when I moved out to Farmingdale, Long Island, they bought a house. They had enough money to buy a house. You know, in 1961, the house was, I think, cost $16,000.
It's you and your sister and your two parents.
Yep. And when I went to school, instead of going to eighth grade, they put me from seventh grade right into high school.
Oh my! So you skipped two grades.
Yeah. So it was, in retrospect, not a good thing to do because I was much younger than everybody else. I graduated high school at 16.
Talk about that. What was it like
trying out for athletics? It was hard. You know, I wanted to play sports. You know, I finally was able to play. lacrosse, but I wasn't as good as everyone because I'm, you know, 13, 14 years old and everybody else is 15, 16 years
old. So you're
old.
2 years younger.
Yeah, I'm basically 2 years younger than everybody else.
Do you feel like that experience was what informed kind of how you carried yourself? Like,
well, actually, it had what I now can look back on is sort of a reverse effect. I became more introverted because I couldn't be successful at what I was doing. I wanted to, you know, my parents wouldn't let me play football. They wouldn't sign for that because they thought it would be too damaging, and they had a vision in their mind that I was going to be a medical doctor, and they didn't want me getting hurt, ruining my hands, whatever. They had this weird thing, but they didn't know what lacrosse was, so they signed to allow me to play lacrosse.
How did you get to lacrosse? Who was it? A coach?
A friend of mine was playing it and said, you ought to come and play, and you know, you're the size. I was 5'10" when I was 14 years old, so I had some size to me. I also threw shot put in high school, but again, I wasn't the best on the team because I was so much younger than everybody else. I was on the track team and I was on the lacrosse team.
What kind of dating life could you have as a young high schooler because every girl was 2 years older than you?
Yes, it was not fantastic.
So not until you got to later in high school that you could date younger high school students that were your age.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, basically, that was, yeah.
Arnie was always playing with the numbers. It's smart, actually. Arnie, it's so funny that you say that, though, because you are an introvert extrovert. Yeah. That is, you're not just, I mean, I see you as extroverted only because I know you and you're comfortable.
Right.
But, and we talk about stuff, but you're right. Like, I could see that side of you where you're kind of hanging back and just waiting to figure out where you're going to come in.
Well, in my high school yearbook, I never really saw myself that way. Because you're not so introspective when you're young.
No.
But I remember the principal signed my high school yearbook and put next to my picture, the quiet man.
Yeah.
And I came out of my shell when one specific thing happened to me in high school. And
what was that?
Well, I ended up also, I ended up being president of what they call the history club. And my favorite teacher in high school was the advisor to that club. And he had just returned from being in the Peace Corps, and he was a really nice, cool young. I mean, I thought of him as a, you know, older teacher, but he's probably 24 years old. He wasn't that old. And we were having a memorial ceremony at the school to unveil a big portrait of John Kennedy, who had been assassinated.
What year is it, 63, 64?
No, this is like 66 or 7.
60, okay.
Or 68, maybe even in there. I don't remember exactly. I was a junior in high school.
Oh, okay.
So it was probably 66, 60. 60, 67, 68. Excuse me. I got it all wrong. That's what happens when you age. It was like 63, 64. So it was only.
Right.
Bobby Kennedy came to, he was the United States Senator from New York and came to the school to speak at this ceremony. And I was up on the stage. I was, first time in my life, I was on a stage. I'd never been in a school play. I'd not been a tree in any event. I mean, I wasn't involved in any of that. We're sitting on the stage, and the faculty advisor's name was Mr. Holtzman, came over and said, are you ready? And I said, well, ready for what? He said, oh, I guess I forgot to tell you, you're introducing Senator Kennedy. And this was not just to the student body, the parents, it was like 5,000 people there. My graduating class in high school was about 900. So the whole school was there, so 3,000 students, plus their parents. I mean, this whole... You know, basketball arena there was full.
Sure.
And I was not prepared to. He said, well, you have to go up there and lead him in the Pledge of Allegiance and introduce Senator Kennedy. And I had never spoken, outside of in front of a class. And I didn't even like speaking in front of a class at that point to an audience. You know, I screwed up my courage and went out. And it was actually a
do you remember the
empowering
feeling?
Experience. Because I said in a meek voice, I think, can I have your attention, please? And everybody shut up immediately. So this is pretty cool.
The power of the mic.
And then I said, I would like to lead you in the Pledge of Allegiance. And would you all rise? And everybody stood up. We did the Pledge of Allegiance. And then afterwards, you know, I'm standing there and going like, you got to introduce the senator. And I had nothing prepared. So all I said was, ladies and gentlemen, Senator from New York, Robert Kennedy. That's all I said. That's all I had to say. Everybody knew who he was.
What happened, though?
Years later, I met Senator Kennedy right before
he died.
Right. But it was an empowering experience to see what kind of influence you could have, you know, by being a little bit
right.
more demonstrative in your behavior. So that was a good experience.
Do you remember what it was like after that day? Like, did people come up
yes.
to you?
Yeah.
And what was that like?
It was like they associated me in some way with Senator Kennedy because he came over and shook my hand. I mean, I had touched a living God in a way.
Absolutely.
At that point in time, he had not announced his run for presidency yet, but he was, you know, he was the brother of the slain president a couple of years after that happened. And he was a very, emotional speaker, you know, and a very charismatic human being. So I had a little bit of good, positive feedback.
Right.
But the Long Island Daily News, Newsday, which was the Long Island paper, had on the, there was a section in it of, you know, local news, and then a picture of me and Kennedy with the picture of his brother on the front page.
Amazing.
So I was a 16-year-old kid, you know, in a suit and tie, standing next to Bobby Kennedy.
Do you have a clipping of that?
Yeah, I have it somewhere.
Can I see that?
Yeah, I'll go look for it.
Incredible.
But anyway, right. So my parents were adamant that they wanted me to be a doctor.
Yeah.
At some point, you know, a Jewish
doctor.
Well, an immigrant dream, right? Come
right.
here. You know, it's an ethnic dream. Indians, Pakistan.
That's
I
right.
mean, everybody comes here, they want to be a professional and be a doctor.
Right.
And I really, you know, I was swept up in it, but I really, in my heart of heart, didn't want to be a doctor. My passion at that point was literature. And I had written, unbeknownst to my parents even, because I had written a bunch of poems that got published in the school literary magazine. And my English teacher, you know, encouraged me. He said, you know, you have, great potential. You have a good vocabulary. You have a good way with words. My grammar was crappy because I had gone to 4 or 5 schools before I went to high school. And in every school I had gone to, they were teaching vocabulary in a different year than I was there. I mean, grammar. So I never learned grammar. I never had a class in grammar.
What do you think sparked your interest in poetry or creative writing? Like anything
Yes. You remember in real time at that point, things were happening like the peace movement, and you had Bob Dylan and Phil Oakes
and
all these people expressing themselves with beautiful, you know, Mr. Tambourine Man. And I mean, all the things that were being written, like a Rolling Stone, all that stuff was going on. You know, I had seen, even in high school, I had seen Dylan live down in the Village. So there was some of that going on and just seeing if I could express myself in a creative way like that. I wrote some fiction stories also, but the poetry seemed to have captured people's interest.
Arnie, but it's so interesting because the Dylans and the Phil Oakes and the Woody Guthrie, they're all, of their time, they were, you know,
well, we used to,
those
I
voices.
Mean, radio. I mean, I remember as you
right.
do, Cousin Bruce Morrow, Cousin Brucey, who's still doing radio on Sirius.
Yes.
He was, you know, I thought of him as an adult, but he wasn't really that much. He was probably in his early 20s. He's in his 80s
W-A-B-C Seedles.
Right, A-B-C, you know, and music was a huge, huge thing. Movies, music, and of course, TV.
And sports.
Right.
Arnie is playing it down. He's a huge sports fan, a huge Yankees fan.
Right. Well, I was born literally close, you know, in the shadows of Yankee Stadium.
But then moved to Queens, where you're near the new Shea Stadium.
Right. I was at the first game ever played at Shea Stadium.
Which is incredible.
That's
62 or 63?
63 against the Pittsburgh Pirates. The rookie star for the Pirates was Willie Stargell back in those days. And the Mets lost 5-4.
Wow.
I think the losing pitcher was Larry Benarth, if you can remember that name.
Yeah.
So, but I did go to Shea Stadium, but I was more interested always in the New York Yankees.
Why?
Well, because as a kid growing up in that era, football wasn't that big, and pro basketball wasn't that big. But baseball was they would broadcast the World Series on the speakers in the public schools. And during my formative years, the Yankees, in an 11-year period, they were in the World Series 9 times.
They were dominant,
you know, and they, you know, and I'll never forget one year where they were playing the Dodgers, you know, who had dissed New York by leaving.
Right.
And I remember listening in the school on the loudspeaker, Sandy Koufax striking out Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, and Tom Tresh in an inning. It was like he was like a god.
That's like
how could you do
wound.
That? How could you do that? How could you strike out the heart of the Yankee?
Especially audience? Sandy Koufax.
Yeah, especially Sandy. So I was a bigger baseball fan during that time. And
did you go to games on your own or with your friends?
I went to some games. My grandfather would take me to some games.
Did he?
In those days, he had a badge that looked like a policeman's badge, being a union officer.
In.
You just flash your badge and walk into the stadium. So we would go to baseball games. I think I went to one basketball game with my father, and I think I went to two baseball games with him. And all the other times, if I went with if it wasn't my friends, I would go with my grandfather.
So
my mother's father died when I was 6 months old, so I really never met him.
Never
knew him.
Did you go to New York Knicks games? Basketball?
I once went.
Because I know you're a big Knicks fan.
I once went to a triple header. They may even still do that at Madison Square Garden. The high school game was Powell Memorial with a guy named Lou Alcindor was playing, who, as our sports informed listeners know, is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in high school. And then I watched NYU play with Hap Hairston and Barry Kramer were the stars of that team.
Barry Kramer.
And then I saw the Knicks play. So I had gone
at the Garden. This was
at
the
Garden. Yeah,
on 48. What's this? Was the old Garden?
The old Garden. You know, and they used to play triple headers. So high school game, college game, pro game.
Arnie, we would be remiss if we did not talk about food growing up.
Oh,
you had told me once that there was a place with the Automat.
Yeah, the Automat.
Talk about the Automat.
Horn and Hardart, which was a retail food company that made pot pies and baked beans and rice pudding, opened this modern, 20th century food place, which had these little glass doors you walked in and you put your change in the slot. And so it would say ham sandwich, salami sandwich, custard pie, whatever you wanted was behind a stainless steel window that you could look in. It was kind of a little bit of a fraud because there were people behind there putting stuff into the shelf. So it wasn't like fully automated. Like, sometimes in Japan, you have these sushi things when they come out on a train. This wasn't that. There were these windows and you could put your cup under to get coffee and you put 10 cents and turn the crank and the coffee came out. So it was it was supposed to be that's why it was called the Automat, the automated food system. And I think they lasted until maybe there was one left maybe 10, 12 years ago. You go online and look up Automat. You can see these big, shiny, stainless steel panel of windows and this food behind each one of them. But when they opened the door and you took it out, you could look behind and there were people, with chef hats and white aprons making the food and just sticking it in. What it did was it got rid of, waiters and waitresses. You didn't need any of them. You went and got the food yourself.
You know what? And everything that goes around comes around. They've now moved back towards
that. Yeah, you could open up a new one now. It'd be a lot of nostalgia for it. So I graduated high school at 16. I turned 17. I went to college.
Started pre-med.
I think it was the funny experience about going to Cincinnati was I was 17 years old. I'd never been on a plane alone. And for those of you who've traveled much, the Cincinnati airport is not in Ohio. It's in Kentucky. So I'm on the plane, and the pilot comes on and says, "We're getting ready to land in Newport, Kentucky." And I freaked out completely. I'm supposed to be going to Cincinnati. How did I screw this up? What's Newport, Kentucky? And I asked some people. They finally said, "Oh, it's just across the river. It's where the airport is." And I got off, and somebody said, "If you want to go to," I said, "I'm going to the University of Cincinnati campus." They gave me some instructions: take a bus, and they sent me to a bus, and the bus went from Newport across the Ohio River,
right.
And the first stop at the first light on the bus in Cincinnati, a guy walks. I'm looking out the window to get to what is this Cincinnati place? And a guy walks out of a bar, turns around. He has a knife sticking out of his chest, a white shirt, knife sticking out of his chest. He falls down on the sidewalk, dead. The bus driver, because he had a CB radio, called the police. And we had to sit there and wait for the police to come and, ask everybody, because we were at the scene of a murder. I lived in New York my whole life. I never saw anybody murdered. My first minute in Cincinnati, Ohio,
murder.
I see somebody die. So that kind of set up my sojourn into at the University.
Do you remember
of Cincinnati.
Getting to campus and telling that story to people?
Yes. And they were all thought I was making it up, or nobody took it as seriously as I thought.
This is 1966, 67.
This is 1965.
65, okay.
1965. And so I'm a freshman.
Parents are still in Farmingdale at this point, right? Not Boston.
Right, no, they're still in Farmingdale.
So you're going back.
I wanted to go further away. I was trying to get as far away as I could. Right, my parents were fairly restrictive. They didn't want me to go to the South because at that point, civil rights workers were being killed. And they thought that and some of them were Jewish that were being killed that were working with with the Afro-American community in the South. They thought I might be a target of something. And they didn't want me to go really too far west because they didn't want me to be too far away. You know, because they realized that I didn't. I'm 17 years old. You know, I'm going to be off on my own for the first time in pre-med, 19 credits, at a, you know, all by myself, not a relative in sight, not a friend. Didn't know anybody at the university. I went there because they gave me a scholarship. They're the first school that responded to my, you know, your application process. They offered me a scholarship. And they had a medical school. So the thought was, you go there and do well in pre-med, you're going to get into medical school.
Your parents didn't go out with you to look at the school. You just went.
No, I just went.
1965, by yourself.
By myself.
2 years younger than probably most freshman enrollees.
Yes.
Which is...
You know, just turned 17. Most of them were 18. I had just turned 17. So
you're a year and a half younger.
I'm a little bit younger. My grandfather took me out, and we went to Barney's in New York, which at that time was not an upscale right. men's clothing place. It was more like a normal clothing store. But he bought me I didn't have much clothes. I was not a wardrobe.
Not like you are today.
No, not like I am today. But he bought me my entire wardrobe. And I remember it was $500. That's what he gave me to go to college. And we bought shoes and socks and underwear and shirts and slacks and belts and a cranberry blazer and a navy pea jacket. And I bought every single thing so that I could go away to college.
And when you were going to school in 1965, you're dressed well. You're going to college. You're not schlumpy. You're not wearing a sweatshirt.
I had penny loafers. I had V-neck sweater. I had a collegiate. Basically, we went there, and I said, "I'm going away to college. Can you help me pick out a college wardrobe?" I didn't even know really what they would wear at a university.
Any desire to play sports in college? You played pickup
basketball. I thought about playing baseball.
Okay.
Because I would never played Little League baseball, but I played in a lot of, amateur pickup games, and I was a pretty decent pitcher.
Huh.
But when I kind of, and they had a freshman baseball team at the University of Cincinnati, along with the varsity team, they had a freshman team. And the Cincinnati baseball team's claim to fame in those days was Sandy Koufax had gone to the University of Cincinnati on a baseball scholarship.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I didn't know it either until I got there. And so I worked with you get assigned a roommate. My roommate was a high school basketball star. I mean, and he wasn't good enough to play in the pros because he was off-sized, but he played very well at Youngstown High School. His parents, ironically, I don't know how we got paired together, but his parents were concentration camp survivors and met at Auschwitz and survived and got married. And Marv, who was very a serious guy and was 2 years older than me, he's now the president of the L.A. Jewish Foundation.
Is that right?
Yeah, he went to law school. I mean, he was very serious. He probably kept me from flunking out of college by being a serious roommate my first couple of years.
Everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
So you're at University of Cincinnati. You start pre-med, but you kind of don't go there. And then you're coming back during the summer and for holidays.
Yeah.
Back
I started pre-med and I was terrible at it. I couldn't, it was boneheaded of me to think I could carry 19 credits of organic chemistry, vertebrate physiology, calculus.
Right.
17 years old, be alone and be exposed to a college campus where Abbie Hoffman was. I mean, there was all this stuff going on campus. Abbie Hoffman went to the University of Cincinnati, one of the Chicago Seven. There's all this stuff going on. Everybody's older than me. You could drink 3-2 beer at 18, 3.2% alcohol. People were going to the hot spot was the Mug Club.
What was that?
I went there a couple of times. I shouldn't have been able to be let in, but I was old. I was older.
You looked the part.
I had shaggy hair and wide rim glasses, and I would be able to get in, but I couldn't really, interact very well at that level. I was nervous about it, and of course, there's girls on campus. There's all these distractions, card playing. I mean, all the stuff that a dorm has, which is good, which is a good experience. It's a good,
it was great for you though, socializing.
It was very hard to focus on academics in that environment.
So when did you pull the plug on pre-med?
When I was on academic probation for a quarter.
I knew you were going to say that.
I mean, that's the wake-up call. I'm going to lose my scholarship if I don't get my act together.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm thinking about what...
Distractions.
I can't tell my parents. They're going to go crazy. Plus, I had to work. My parents didn't have much money at that point in time to pay me. I usually held two or three part-time jobs while I was taking 19 credits, while I was doing all this stuff. Who knows? But I was painting warehouses. I was working in the residence hall as an RA, residential advisor.
What was your guilty pleasure while you were doing all these things? Did you have a guilty pleasure? In college, because you're a man of, there are things that you like to do, and you've developed those tastes over the years.
I was.
Did it start here?
It didn't start.
Not food. Not food.
No, I was actually in great shape. I didn't eat that much. You ate in the dorm.
You ate in great shape and eat.
You ate in the cafeteria and all of that.
Music.
Yeah. So I was assessing what could I do that would keep me close enough that my parents would go crazy. And the one class that I was doing very well in was psychology.
Ah.
And you could go to medical school with a psychology degree, undergraduate psychology degree, because you could say you were working towards being a psychiatrist.
Sure.
So I switched my major to psychology. And for the last, we were on a quarter system. For the last 2.5 years, I made Dean's List every quarter. So I found something that resonated with, and I made Dean's List, and, my grade point average went up, and, everything, went great.
Arne, so you're doing that. Do you have friends that, Marv is one of them, that you still keep in touch with from Cincinnati?
Yeah, there are a few that I keep in touch with, and they're all off in different places, and of course we're all older now, but they all turned out, all my friends turned out that I was close to turned out living fulfilling lives of interest to them.
As we are talking to Arne Sherman, my co-host and guest interview subject here on What Do You Know. Arne, in our remaining minutes for this show, because part two is coming.
Uh-huh. We only got to the point where I'm 18 years old.
I know. I had to write down the timeline, and I just see where we are, and I know we have another show, if not two, here. In Cincinnati is where you met your wife.
Well, actually, if we're going to be honest, I met my first wife. I was married.
Oh. Okay.
I was.
We're always going to be honest. We have to be honest.
We have to be honest. So I was 19 years old, and... Marv's high school sweetheart, who he's still married to all these years later, had a roommate who was a local woman from Cincinnati. They fixed me up on a blind date, and we went out. And it was okay.
Right.
I didn't really say, wow, I've met my dream girl. But apparently she went home and told her family that she met her dream guy.
From New York.
Yeah, and the first date we ever had, we went to see... Steve McQueen and the Sand Pebbles, which was a great movie, and with Richard Crenna and Steve McQueen. And then I didn't ask her out again. And about 2 months later, I ran into her at a cafeteria, and, you feel kind of, awkward at that point.
Sure.
I said, I'm making excuses, and I asked her out again. I said, we should go out again. And we went out, and we started dating, and my mother, who... eventually figured out that I wasn't going to go to medical school and I didn't have a first good 2 years. She thought I should get married young just like she did and my father because they were 18 and 20. My mother had me when she was 19.
Right.
My grandfather was 46 when I was born. I mean, it was a young family.
Very young.
In those days, it was young. She really sort of got into cahoots with Beverly, who was my first wife, and all of a sudden I was getting married. I got married before I graduated. I got married.
That was more commonplace, right?
Get married in college. You remember they were things called you would get pinned,
yeah,
and then engaged and then get married. So I got married, and I Beverly is still alive somewhere, and I don't wish her any. She probably had a very fulfilling, wonderful life, but I really realized
You're too young.
Even the day I was doing it, that this is not what I should be doing.
Arnie, I forgot.
Yeah, yeah.
You're right.
And that lasted a few years, and we divorced.
And you stayed in Cincinnati.
Well, I went to college, graduated college, and then I was going to go into the, I was draft, you know, they used to have the draft, and I was 1A.
Yeah.
And it was.
Good shape.
And the Vietnam War is going on.
This is 1967?
This is 1969.
Oh, geez.
Right in the belly of it. And there's a lottery. I mean, there's a draft, and I'm 1A. And all my friends are sitting around saying, I'm going to Canada. One of them went to officer training. One of them went into the reserves. They're all trying to figure out how to defer being sent over there. Because I had friends from high school that were all dead now.
Not because you're not patriotic.
No.
She didn't believe in this war because it was a war.
Well, I had a career goal, and all of a sudden, you know, nowadays we have a volunteer army. People go in the army and sacrifice and defend their country, and it's great. But they volunteer to do it. They make a conscious decision.
Right.
This is 1A on your draft card. You show off your draft board, and you take a physical, and then you're in the army. So that's what I was facing when I graduated my senior year, that I wasn't going to be going to graduate school. I had been accepted into NYU graduate program in psychology, and I was going to come back to New York and get my doctorate, and you know I was going to pursue being a clinical psychologist. And my draft board says you got to show up in September.
So you remember that day?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, I decided at that point that I would go. I mean, I'm not going to try to run away. I'm not going to try. I decided it was a numbers game. I didn't know how much longer the war was going to last, but it had been going on for a long time, and there was a lot of peace activism, and it was winding down, I thought, even though there was horrible news every day. I was going to go into officer training. I said, if they take me and I pass my physical, which I thought I would,
right,
I'm going to go into officer training. It takes about 6 or 9 months to go through officer training, and I was just going to play the odds that by that time the conflict might be over or in its last throes. Whatever. So that was my plan. I wasn't going to leave the country like some of my friends went to Canada. Some of them, you know, again, went into officer, you know, went into reserve. I said, if they draft me, if that's my fate, I might as well be an officer.
That must have been so scary.
I don't want to be an infantryman. I'm going to be an officer.
No bone spurs there, folks.
My dad was in the army. My uncle Harry was in the Marines. My father's brother, my uncle Alan, was in the Navy. I'll do my time. I'll go, but I don't want to go in the middle of this.
Right.
You know, my dad, when he went, he didn't get drafted. He volunteered. Every one of my relatives volunteered.
Volunteered. That was their duty.
I had a different career path, and that war went by 69 was very unpopular.
So put a pin in this. So your officer training school, officer training.
Is what I was going to do.
What happened?
Well, a friend of mine named John Malzone said, hey, what are you going to do till you get drafted? I said, I don't know. He said, I just got a summer job at the Ohio Bureau of Vocational Rehabilitation. Pays $100 a week, which was not bad money in those days for somebody, you know, young. You know, I graduated high college at 20.
Right.
So I just turned 21 at that point. He said, I can get you a job down there for the summer. You might as well go to work. So I go to work at the Bureau of Vocational Rehabilitation. They got this young kid. They give me the worst caseload there. I had 400 clients. They gave me a case. Somebody had left 6 months earlier. Nobody had paid attention to any of their clients. And I had 400 cases, people waiting for prosthetic limbs. I mean, just a whole. But I thought it was kind of an interesting job, and I threw myself into it. And at the end of the summer, I went in to see the head of the office in Cincinnati. And I said, you know, I'm going to have to leave because my draft board wants me to show up on September 21st. And they said, what happens if we can get you an occupational deferment? Would you stay here and work? And I said, sure. I like the work, actually.
Right,
it's pretty interesting.
Right.
It wasn't my career path, but I'll compare it to going in the. So the governor of Ohio, at that time his name was Jim Rhodes, wrote a letter to my draft board saying, we need this person. This is a valuable position, and it's hard to fill. And my draft board gave me an occupational deferment.
And you did not have to go.
No. And then the next year, to end this up, the next year, the lottery came in. There was a lottery.
The war
was still going on a year later. And the lottery came in, and they picked, it was on the radio, and everybody sat around the radio listening to them drawing the numbers. So they would draw Right. May 22nd was number one. June 2nd was number two. And I had called my draft board and had asked them, what number will you draft up to? And they said, up to 118. If you got 118 or...
Right. You have to listen.
And I got 286.
This is...
So I didn't get drafted, and I gave up my occupational
job
deferment and, and took another job at a halfway house for ex-convicts.
And we're going to leave it there, folks, because that's a cliffhanger. Back after these words with Arnie Sherman, our co-host and guest. We'll be back next week with part two of the Arnie Sherman story here on What Do You Know? See you next week, Arnie.
Hopefully I'll be back.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.